Hello, welcome to the Do Lectures podcast with me, Gav Thompson. Today on ... we talk to Claire Elson. Claire was a stockbroker in London, living a pretty normal life until a chain of events led to her getting on a motorbike and riding on her own from London to Cape Town. On the ride, many crazy things happened, not least that she ended up setting up a charity in Tanzania called Piccalilli, which helps train women how to ride bikes, and in doing so, how to help the community. It's a brilliant story, so please sit back, grab a coffee, put your feet up, and listen to Claire Elson's ... So welcome to the Do Lectures podcast, Claire.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here with you today.
Very excited to have you here. You have an amazing story. Why don't you recap us how you got to be doing a Do Lecture at 12 hours notice in 2015? Give us the backstory to that and then we'll sort of pick it up from 2015.
Yes. Well, I'd originally actually heard about the Do Lectures because I used to be at the yoga class that Michael Townsend Williams used to give in Bradford and Avon. He told me all about it. I was well sold at that point. So I'd applied to be a participant and I was delighted to have got a spot. So I was already very happy to have arrived and to be at the event. Obviously, Do Lectures being a really social event, and that's one of the points of magic of it, you know, the gatherings around the campfire and those amazing meals together. But I think it was at one of those meals or various of those campfire events where inevitably people say, who are you? What are you up to? And I remember being at a table with Tim Leroy and he said, so who are you? And I said, well, I'm a stockbroker.
That's a great opener. So if you're sure you've come to the right place.
Yeah, he was like, okay. But actually, what I love is motorcycling. And I've just come back from this motorcycle trip. And I told a bit about my story and this current dilemma I was having at the time. And he was interested in the story. And it was really great to retell it again. And I ended up retelling it a few times. And then I think it was that night or a night later, Tim pulled me aside and said, look, we've had a cancellation, actually. Somebody who was meant to be speaking tomorrow can't make it anymore. I know it's short notice, but would you be up for stepping in?
Wow.
Yeah, obviously head blown at that point because I totally understood the gig. You know, speaking at the Do Lectures is an incredible opportunity. It's a massive privilege. And of course, they're recorded. So whatever you say is not just limited to the folks in the room. It's out there forever.
It's out there on the internet for the rest of time.
Exactly.
How did you get involved in motorbikes? Because even that, I happen to be a biker myself, but it's a minority sort of interest sport at the best of times. Plus, you have been able to fix them as well. So why don't you tell us just the motorbikes part of the story?
Okay, well, actually, that is linked to the broking, bizarrely enough, because... So in my first job, I was working in Canary Wharf. So, and as a broker, I had to be at my desk by 6:30 in the morning. And at that point, I was renting a room in Parsons Green. So for people who don't know the geography of London, Canary Wharf being...
That's a long and crappy commute.
Really crappy. And especially when you basically, that will necessarily mean you probably have to be leaving home at 5:30 in the morning. And if you're lying on the tube network, that's, I think at the time it was three tubes. And if you missed a connection, you were out by 15 minutes. And the pressure of the job anyway meant that you had to be at your desk the minute you were meant to be at your desk. And any delays were not tolerated well. So that for me was just not an enjoyable experience. And I particularly remember on one of the tubes, I think it was the connection I had to make in Westminster. I was often stuck on the second tube with, you know, especially those early morning journeys. It's the same familiar faces taking the same seats in the same carriage every day. And I was getting stuck with this girl who I may have been a marathon sort of runner or something. I don't know. But every morning at 5:45, she would be cracking open a Tupperware tub of chicken pasta salad. And the smell of it would just immediately carry through the carriage. And I could not stomach that. It was horrendous. So I thought something's going to have to change here. This is grim and that pasta salad's rank. However, salvation was upon me because a couple of my colleagues were bikers and they said, look, why don't you just learn to ride a motorbike? Just get a Vespa or something, just something low key, but make sure you get your full license because certainly at the moment in the UK, the way the basic training for motorbikes is run, it really is alarmingly basic given how much danger you can get yourself into.
Any fool can ride a Vespa within a couple of hours, really.
Exactly. And then you're loose on the streets of London. It's terrifying.
Yeah, it is terrifying.
So that wasn't great. So I thought that was a fun idea. I had a few rides on the back of colleagues' motorbikes, and immediately, I think it's a fairly Marmite experience. You either love the freedom or hate the vulnerability. And I loved the freedom. I just thought it was great. So I took my test and inevitably then wanted a big 500cc or so bike, because I just thought it was, the possibilities that it promised were just endless. And so ended up buying a 650cc motorbike as my first bike, which was pretty crazy. And it went from there, got into off-roading again through different colleagues. So wow. It just built.
How did you go from enjoying biking in London to being able to kind of strip a motorbike engine down and fix it, repair it? That's not an obvious link.
No, it's not. It's not. And I would say, just for the benefit of everyone's, you know, clarity, I would say I'd be challenged to totally strip down an engine. I would say my skills are probably more limited to various types of exhaustive maintenance, and I can do some bits beyond that, but I am not by any stretch a full-on mechanic. I did actually once start taking a college course in mechanics, but that's another story. In terms of how the leap went, that didn't actually happen through necessarily any organic process in the UK before I went on my trip. It actually happened through necessity. So when I set off on my motorbike trip from the UK to Cape Town, which I think we'll get onto, essentially I realized very quickly that I was going to have to do all the maintenance very regularly, because that bike's health and well-being was absolutely correlated to my own. You know, if a tire blew out for lack of adequate tire pressure, for example, I would be in deep shit, basically. Or any one of those issues that can crop up that actually are totally avoidable that would give me a big headache, I wanted to make sure I was on top of those things.
So you were a stockbroker in London, life was pretty good, I guess, and you had a sort of epiphany moment, which I think involved your granny, is that correct?
Correct.
Tell us about your granny's role in all of this, and then tell us what you then did.
So what happened was, you're right in, to an extent, I was financially doing well, and from what some people, and I would say that very advisedly, might consider to be a sort of, a high status sort of a job. I think 10 years on, we can certainly think about what a job that might inspire others might look like, rather than being necessarily a stockbroker. But at the time it was, you know, had a bit of status, good money, but I didn't feel like my life was a wealthy one in the deeper sense. And that was nagging at me, because it got to a point where I'd be given a promotion, a pay rise, and I just felt very dead inside about it. It wasn't exciting. I didn't think, oh, great, now I can buy more stuff. I just wanted my time and I wanted my energy. I was permanently exhausted. My life lacked texture. It was constantly stressful, but there was no real reward for it in a sort of deeper sense. And I just felt like this was untenable. And so what happened was, at the same time, my gran, my father's mother, had been living in a care home for about a year. And she had always been, so she's from the north of England. I sort of used to think she was quite like a mountain goat sort of a character, because she was just strongly built. She'd really lived through some quite tough times, as many of her generation had. And I just had always thought that she would go on forever and always be physically jumping on and off buses and all that sort of stuff. And then one day she had a fall in her care home and she broke both the bones in her lower arm. And all of a sudden, you know, I went to visit her in hospital, and all of a sudden it seemed like she had shrunk down overnight from being their super grand character to being very fragile and frail. And she looked like a totally different person. And it was quite alarming, actually, just like how quickly that seemed to have happened. And I think she was feeling pretty shaken up by it. And we were just talking about, you know, her, how she was doing, all of these sorts of things. And suddenly she just kind of looked at me at the end of the hospital bed in a surprisingly tender fashion. I say surprisingly tender because she wasn't somebody who was naturally necessarily sort of overly warm to an extent. I mean, I don't want to make that such, she was a loving woman, but what I would say is she was somebody who valued sort of practicality and resilience above all things, which is fine in itself. But I think to have this sudden moment of a sort of tender conversation was quite striking coming from her, especially, but also it was the content of what she said. So she just said to me out of the blue, you know, I wish that when I was your age, I'd done the things that I'd really wanted to do, not the things that other people expect me to do. You know, she said, I wish I'd been braver, and I wish I'd just done those things I'd wanted to do. And well, I kick myself now that I didn't say in that moment, well, tell me about it, Gran. You know, what would you have done? You know, I want to hear about what your dreams were. And I missed that opportunity in that moment. And the cruel thing was, when I actually thought to ask her later and was actually in the same room with her later, like 2 years later, she totally denied we'd ever had this conversation.
Oh, wow. Maybe she was channeling some kind of higher power, kind of Yoda
this is
it's amazing. I mean, that's even more nuts that she goes, I never said that.
Did I say that? Oh, I don't
did I say
so.
That?
What? Wow. This was pivotal, Gran.
So she can take no credit for this, nor can the lady with the pasta salad on the tube. The two people that were the catalysts are both not aware that they've, you know, changed your life. Okay, she gave you this amazing advice, and what did you conclude to then do about it?
Well, my natural takeaway from it, which certainly wouldn't have been many others necessarily, but my natural takeaway was to think, the thing I've been wanting to do for ages, and this was very much inspired by Ewan McGregor and Charlie Borman's Long Way Down trip, that was pivotal, because at the time it was before Netflix and things, so I was watching this DVD quite religiously, quite often during the week after trying to decompress. And eventually the DVD scratched so much, I think, it's died. And I thought, God, that's a sign. I've got to either, you know, never watch this again and just get alive, or just do the thing myself. Just get out there. It doesn't matter that I don't know what I'm going to do next. It doesn't matter that I don't have the whole support crew. And, you know, other women have done this before, you know, not many, admittedly, but Lois Price was a massive inspiration to me. She's ridden that route, admittedly, more via the West Coast, which, you know, you could say is an even greater adventure. But
yeah,
it is possible.
You basically go, my life's great on one level, but I'm not living an abundant life in other areas. My granny's had this sort of channeled this amazing piece of advice, and I've been really inspired by Ewan and Charlie. And you thought, I tell you what, I'm going to get a bike and I'm going to ride from London to Cape Town, yeah?
Yes, that's a fair conclusion, yeah.
Why?
One of the big things for me, I think, had been, I hadn't grown up surrounded by stockbrokers and city folk, and being, you know, I'm from Wiltshire originally. And so for me, I felt like I'd got kind of a little bit lost. And I think a lot of people actually do in their 20s. You kind of end up being, you are at risk of being slightly consumed by the things you come into contact with. And for me, my job was very all encompassing, very intense, and operating the world where, you know, the things that get valued are obviously profits and financial returns. Conviction about everything, even when you probably really don't know what you're talking about necessarily, or at best you have an educated guess, but you don't know everything. You know, expressions like, oh, throw money at the problem, or things like this, having alpha meetings where people shout over each other to get their point heard in a 2-minute thing about why a certain stock is absolutely going to go up by 50% the next 6 months. You know, it's kind of nonsense, really. What I missed was just, is this really what is the most important thing in the world to be essentially graded or valued on the extent to which you can guess which way companies are going to go up and down in price and maybe the value of my house? Or is that really the most important and valuable and beautiful thing I can possibly be working towards? And I kind of thought, I don't think that this is, at least for me, that is not the be all and end all. But I got very lost and confused in all of that. And so there was a real desire for me to just strip it all down. I mean, I love motorbikes anyway, but what I loved was the fact that they do, in a mixed blessing kind of way, make you very vulnerable to the environment around you. You know, when it rains, you feel the rain on your face. When it's cold, your fingers freeze. But similarly, when you pull into a petrol station in somewhere different, people want to start a conversation with you because they might be interested in you, your bike, what you're doing, what you're up to. It's a conversation starter. And so you're going to learn about different places and what they value and how other people live. And just get a bit more perspective on the way the world really works and what really matters. And I think that's what I was really trying to get to. And I was trying to find what could be an alternative path for me, because I just didn't feel as though I was going to end up in a very happy life continuing as I was. And that was worrying to me.
How did everyone respond with the news of your trip?
Well, I think apart from within the sort of overland motorcycling community, who are all very excited. Outside of that small bubble, relatively small bubble, I think most people were horrified, but would dress that up by saying, that's really brave, which is obviously just, you're crazy. And then one individual in particular who I linked up with on a sort of Welsh off-roading experience, who I'd known previously in South Africa, made the rather grim statement to me of, I hope you've made peace with what is almost certainly going to happen to you, which was quite a sort of miserable and doom-laden
forecast.
Yes,
yeah,
absolutely.
Well,
absolutely.
Look at you now.
Yes,
yeah,
still
you
alive.
Are, sir, you got it wrong. I know Egypt was challenging. Tell us about Egypt.
I think the main reason, there's so much to say about Egypt, but the main thing that was challenging there was that I had assumed that because I was dressing quite conservatively. I mean, I was in sort of like long-sleeved, high-necked, technical, very unattractive hiking shirts and long-sleeved zip-off khaki trousers, like really not sexy attire as you and I might consider it. I thought, well, I'm behaving prudently. I'm just being, you know, discreet. I'm just riding through the country. What's the big deal? But actually, it was a big deal. And I found time and time and again in Cairo, in a city and smaller cities, similarly through the Western Desert and the oasis towns I rode through there, I was being, and most terrifyingly, on the roads between oasis towns where there is nothing. You are in the desert. No one really uses those roads very frequently. It's quite isolated. I was getting really picked on by truckers, passers-by, people who just thought I was fair game because it seemed as though they thought, you know, people would ask me, where's your husband? Where's your father? Where's your brother? You know, a male should be with you. And they weren't. And they just assumed that, I think, not wanting to second guess anybody, but I think they thought her family have obviously just sort of cast her aside. Otherwise, she wouldn't be on her own. So she must have no honor. She must be a loose woman. And kind of she's up for grabs, quite literally, which was horrific. For quite a long time, I actually felt very chased through the country. I had truckers literally trying to hunt me down on the roads between the oases. My bike had a top speed of 55 miles an hour anyway, because it was only a 400cc bike. So a chase wasn't great for me anyway. And there were petrol shortages anyway in those areas. So I was trying to just ride economically for that purpose as well. Try throwing money at that problem. That wasn't going to help. So it was just terrifying. However, what was incredible was that in the end, I ended up in a hotel in Egypt in one of those oasis towns where, after another particularly bad incident at another hotel I tried to check into, but that's a whole other story. The hotel owner picks up on the fact that I had basically spent 3 days in my hotel room, which is more or less a pizza oven. It was one of those sort of brick buildings with nothing in it and nothing to do there. And he sort of said, oh yeah, why don't you go out and explore the town? And he picked up that something was not right, that I was quite afraid actually and slightly traumatized. He said, I think you should go shopping. And I thought, what a sexist comment, you know, immediately up on my wild, typical man thinking of, you know, all of that nonsense. And I said, look, I'm on a motorbike. I'm really not here to shop. You know, that's not really my thing. He said, no, please. I'm telling you as a brother, you need to go shopping for clothes. And I thought, I don't know what this comment is, but clearly I didn't get any creepy vibes off this guy. He's called Zach, a lovely man. I thought, I'm just going to follow this advice. I don't understand it, but I'm just going to do it. Went down to the local shop that he had recommended, and the shopkeeper, who's also a man, sort of took me under his wing. This place was ram-packed with jalabas, you know, the long robes that the women wear and headscarves.
Yeah.
And he said, I'll pick some off that you might like. The robe he gave me was like at least 8 sizes bigger than I'd normally wear. And I said to him, oh, I'm sorry, I think no, that's your size. And I realized immediately, firstly, my clothes had been outrageously tight by local standards. You could actually see silhouettes and everything. But also, it just was the wrong thing to be wearing, however much it covered my body. It didn't do it adequately. And as soon as I stepped out, looking like Mystic Meg in the end, actually, with this massive robe on, and it was a fire hazard of note because it was very synthetic fibers in that thing. But still, the cultural reaction was fascinating. And I think people actually, I sort of got a sense of relief from the shopkeepers that I was buying things from. She's dressed properly now.
This is funny, isn't it? Because we're all taught as bikers that you have to wear tight-fitting clothing for safety reasons so that it doesn't rub with your skin if you come off the bike. Even if you're wearing, as you said, quite unattractive sort of technical biking gear, it is still by definition figure-hugging, which is probably was setting all these kind of hairs running. Because Egypt was quite early on in the journey to be getting some pretty horrible experiences and getting chased and probably feeling quite scared for your life, I'd imagine.
Yeah, and I just thought, what is the point in continuing this journey if I am literally going to be chased the length of the continent? There's no value in that. I wasn't doing it to set a speed record or something. I was there to sort of engage with people, and it was horrible. But the thing that I really thought was, well, maybe my gut, I just don't think that everybody is going to react towards me like that. And I also think that within myself, I'm going to increasingly learn cultural norms and probably stand out. I'll always stand out, but I'll maybe start to understand better how to behave appropriately in the places I travel through. And I just believe that, you know, most people in the world are good. And I had so much to learn. I was prepared to take a little bit more risk to get to that point. So I just thought, you know, I've already been shown that here's a good guy.
And so that was obviously a bit testing. And tell us about something amazing that happened on the trip.
So I was in Zambia and I was beetling along, and I knew that I had about 200 miles to go, which should have been fine because I had a 17 litre fuel tank and that was normally absolutely fine for me. But bizarrely, there hadn't been petrol stations for a very long time. And unfortunately, the road was actually a lot more hilly than I'd expected. So I was just eating up through my petrol, which was not good news. Before I knew it, I was riding through a very small village with like speed bumps built into them, like really high, like little pyramids, three in a row, horrible things. And on the, I think it was the third or fourth stretch of these speed bumps, just as I was about to be leaving the furthest edge of this village, the bike spluttered to a stall and I came cruising to a stop. I was out of petrol and there was no sign of a petrol station in this village. So I got off the bike and just scratched my head and thought, what on earth am I going to do? It's really hot. I really don't know. I mean, it's a pretty basic village. People are living in like mud huts with straw roofs. This is not ideal. Before I know it, a man in a brown suit came out of his hut and approached me and he sort of intimated that he wanted to help. I said, oh, that's great. And he spoke a little bit of English actually. So I explained the problem that I needed some petrol. And he said to me, oh, no problem. I'm going to help you. And before I knew it, a minibus was driving down the street. He'd flagged it down. He'd had a chat with a guy who was driving the minibus. And he said to me, you get in. They're going to go to the next village. There's no petrol here, but you'll find some at the next village. So come back in a minute and you can go on your way. And I thought, oh, that's absolutely fantastic. Thank you. Got in the minibus. The door slams shut. We start driving off down the road. And then I suddenly think to myself, hang on a minute. Who are these
just
people?
Been had.
I've just left my whole motorbike loaded up with all my stuff. My sat nav is on there. It's not that hard to get it off. What on earth have I just done? But I thought, it's not a problem. We're going to get to the next village. I'll get the petrol. I'll be back in 5 minutes. It'll be fine. Unfortunately, though, we got to this next village. They'd run out of petrol because there was some big World Cup match or something going on at this time. So everyone had got petrol to get to somewhere with a TV. So the only place we could get petrol was to continue another 40 minutes down the road to the main town and buy it there. Not good. So we continue down the road. We pass the usual things, a few more villages, an overturned bus that was now leaking stuff all over the sidewalk, all of that sort of stuff. We get to this town. I managed to buy a jerry can, which is a really plastic oil container from the guy who was driving the minibus. Probably at exorbitant rates, but it didn't matter. Bought this jerry can, filled it up with petrol, managed to blag a ride back towards whatever village it was. I realised by this point I had no idea even what the name of the village was. And I just thought, hopefully I'll recognise it. So eventually the bus sets off. I've got my petrol. I'm sitting in this minibus next to, you know, a lady with some chickens that are pecking at me and I'm being poked by a child. And it's all rather bizarre. But I'm just thinking, what on earth is happening? I've been gone for over an hour now. I don't know the name of the village. I don't know the name of that man. I don't have even a phone. Like, I've got no way of reaching him. There's no chance my bike's going to still be there when I get back. This is a total nightmare. But I'm trying to keep it under control. So we continue down the road, go past the bus that's turned over, that's still now drawing a crowd. Eventually, we get to the outskirts of the village that I recognise. So I sit banged on the bus. That's the way of asking it to stop. I get out, and to my delight, I can see my bike still there. It's still loaded up. And this guy is still there in his brown suit, now joined by a bunch of his mates. So I cross the road. I said, oh, hi, thank you so much. You're still here. And this guy starts up saying at me, oh my goodness, I have been freaking out. Where have you been? I've been thinking, has she disappeared? Has she gone? I have her motorcycle. I have no idea her name. And so he had been freaking out as much as I had. Aww. That he'd skipped church to guard my motorcycle with his Amazing. Mates and the son. And I said to him, look, I'd love to give you a token of my thanks. And he accepted it, a few dollars. And he said, one thing, please remember me. And I thought, oh gosh. I said, sorry, I don't understand. He said, please remember me. My name is Maxwell. I said, absolutely. Yeah, I will remember you, Maxwell. He said, no, I need you to remember, next time you see a petrol station, think Maxwell, think Phil Tanky, Phil Tanky. I said, okay, Maxwell, I get what you're Maxwell. Saying. I need to keep the petrol topped up. So,
well, Maxwell, you're getting remembered right
yeah,
now.
Yeah,
so how long did it take to get from London to Cape Town?
I took about a year to do it because I stopped off in Malawi for a couple of months to do a voluntary placement that I'd organised in advance of the trip. So about a year.
So catch us up on what's happened to you since the trip and on Piccalilli and your story since doing that amazing life-changing trip.
So I got back to the UK. I had a couple of wilderness months where I tried to write a book. Turns out that's much harder than you might think. And for various reasons, I decided, you know what, maybe the best thing is to go back to London, go back to work, figure things out, just try and get back to doing something, earning some money, for example. I ended up back in another stockbroking job, which was really kind of great on the one hand to have some income again, but at the same time, it felt like a real step in the wrong direction, if you know what I mean. Sadly, first of all, my motorbike was stolen within about 2 weeks of going back to London, which kind of felt like the universe saying, damn you, Claire.
So you shipped the bike back to London and then someone nicked it?
Yeah. Yeah,
that's a sign of something, isn't it?
It really felt like it. But you know what was fascinating about that? Much as it was painful, but it actually forced me to kind of keep the trip alive in a different way rather than just riding around on this thing that was the touchstone to so much else. And I ended up, through various ways, speaking at a couple of events. I'd spoke about the fact that in Malawi, I had done this placement with actually a microfinance organization, but who had needed help maintaining and taking care of their fleet of motorbikes that they used to get their loan officers to remote and rural communities to lend money to them so that they could send their kids to school and things and build businesses. So this obsession with maintenance started to become sort of known in the motorbiking community. And I was approached by an organization who said, really interesting. We're about to start a new project in Tanzania, and we want to train midwives to ride and maintain motorbikes so that they can go out into rural communities and help run clinics to keep women safer who are pregnant or who are about to give birth. Would you go out there and run the training and check it out for us? Which I just thought, well, obviously I'd love to do that. So I went out there, did that training, which was just amazing. And I remember thinking to myself, God, if only I could do this every day, you know, it's great. It doesn't feel like work, even though it definitely is. But at the same time, one of the things I started to learn a lot about beyond the huge issue of maternal mortality in Africa was also the fact that everywhere people were riding motorbikes as taxis. And at first I thought this was great because, you know, it was giving young men employment and helping people access markets and healthcare and things. I was actually being hosted at the time by a doctor who was running this project. And he said, yeah, you know, it looks good and it is in many ways, but what you're not seeing is the results of the huge crash rate that these things incur because these guys aren't licensed. They've got no idea about any kind of road safety. Things have got so bad in Tanzania that in every hospital there is a dedicated motorbike crash ward. It's hard to even imagine. Ooh, but these broken bodies,
motorbike
are being,
crashes are not fun.
They are not fun. Yeah. And that's the thing, it's for the rider, but also the passenger is often the one that comes off worst. And so I kind of thought, well, I actually ended up going into a motorbike crash ward to see it for myself. And it was as horrific as you can imagine and real. And I thought, okay, I can see the problems and they're not just immediate because often the hospital's not really set up for this. It throws families into poverty because it'll eat up months of money to pay for the hospital bills. People are often left with long-term problems. You know, a simple broken leg quickly becomes septic. It escalates quickly. So I thought, well, this is something maybe I can actually do something to help because I know about maintenance training. I know a bit about motorbike safety as well. If what's needed here is actually some training sessions for the local community around motorbike safety in all its forms, maybe I could set up something to help deliver that. The other thing, the part of this, is that I've become really passionate about empowering women to run businesses and take on sort of leadership positions in communities. And this was something that the microfinance organization had really showcased for me, that if you enable a woman to have that opportunity to start a business, you know, they reinvest so much more of their profits back into their families. They're often really great business owners because they're used to balancing home budgets. So I thought maybe I could link that in as well. So long story short, did a load of research, ended up moving out there in, I think it was March, April 2016.
To Tanzania?
To Tanzania, not to the same town, actually, to another town called Mwanza, where I really didn't know anybody, and moved into what turned out to be a cockroach and rat-infested hovel near the shores of Lake Victoria to set up this thing in a country where I couldn't speak the language and didn't really have any money, but what could go wrong?
And what did?
plenty, pretty much everything. Well, I mean, it was kind of like several shades of horror, really, but brilliantly so. I mean, obviously not learning Swahili was a challenge. Being visibly a foreigner, and obviously that was surmountable through lessons and that sort of thing, but being visibly green, so to speak, about, you know, how things work in Tanzania, in retrospect, what probably would be pretty obvious ways in which not to get sort of screwed over. To give you some context, I tried to register originally as a social enterprise. The concept itself is not even known in Tanzania. You're either a for-profit company or you're a charity. Trying to explore a grey area, total nightmare. In so doing, I got screwed over by three separate lawyers, one of whom robbed me of 666,000 shillings. People have this expression, he ate my money, which literally means, you know, he had just had a great time paying his own bills and probably going out for some dinners with the money that he was meant to use the to pay for my tax bill on my behalf in setting up this company. It was a total mess. Got screwed also on setting up my residence permit. That lawyer tried to steal $1,000 from me in the process, which was, again, spectacular. I caught amoebic dysentery. That was a laugh.
Well, that's not fun.
No.
I've had
stuff.
A dose of that in Malawi, actually. That's
just horrible.
It's good for
really.
Horrible.
Yes. Yeah, just really difficult. However, I also had, as often the way, some really amazing strokes of luck. So not least to be connected with an amazing individual called Halidi, who was a local guy who is a fantastic carpenter and who was known, very well known for the fact that he, you know, he built a lot of joinery and carpentry projects for expats, had his own business, but just knew everybody who was good in town. We linked up because he's also a biker. He soon said to me, well, hold on, what do you need here? You need a site where you can base your project from. Turns out there's a site just around the corner for me. It's basically rubble at the moment, but I can help you build somewhere cheaply. We can get a workshop up and running in no time, I'm sure. We managed to crowdfund for that, which was just a really cool experience because people literally felt like they could buy some bricks or buy a window or whatever it was. Very soon, the workshop started taking shape. We started to find really awesome women who were prepared to be real pioneers, actually, insofar as, you know, women don't ride motorcycles in Tanzania. So for women to be trained up to train others in the community to stay safe, but also to ride motorbikes themselves and showcase their abilities in the local community, that's brave stuff. But we found some very cool women who were prepared to do that.
And so when did this sort of kick off?
End of 2016, we had the workshop largely built, I think, and then it was sort of going into early 2017. And then things started like building up their own incredible steam. So I then got contacted in 2017 by a very, very large gold mining company that said to us, we've got operations in Mali, in the Ivory Coast, in the rural DRC. We've got communities where our sites are based who are also suffering from this road safety problem. But you've also got staff who ride motorcycles who keep having accidents. And that's affecting our statistics that we have to report back to our shareholders to do with accident rates on the site. So that's intolerable. Would it be possible to fly you to the Ivory Coast and you can come out and do some training there? And similarly in rural DRC. And so suddenly I was being sent around the continent running these training workshops in these most incredible remote places, running these training sessions and train over 1,000 people that way in the space of a couple of weeks, which was brilliant. But one of the things that was actually even more exciting about that was they wanted me to train the riders, but my thing was, I'm really delighted to do that, but let's also train the passengers, because quite often it's women who are choosing who they're going to be selecting to be their rider on their motorbike ride. So if you empower women to understand at a glance what a clearly dangerous motorcycle looks like, you know, bald tires, lights aren't working at nighttime, that kind of thing, and train them why wearing a helmet is important, then you can keep people safer. That was regarded as a nutty idea at first, but actually we had incredible turnout for those events. You know, hundreds of women would turn up, and we quickly realized that that was a really great way of spreading the message and creating a sort of carrot mechanism rather than a stick, because relying on the road traffic authorities to reinforce our messages was just a non-starter. But people power, customer power really works. So that's how that started.
What about life sort of more recently since then, where you're at the moment?
So Halidi that I mentioned is now my husband. So we moved back to the UK in 2019. Well, he's an awesome guy. What's not to love, right?
This story is the story that keeps on giving. I mean, it's amazing.
It absolutely is. We had to move back to the UK in 2019, it was sort of mid-2019, and largely because of this ongoing sticky issue with residence permits, because without going into boring detail, Magufuli, who actually only recently died of COVID, the then president of Tanzania, had very much like a sort of pro-national approach to everything. And that meant that as a foreigner, getting a work permit was really, really hard. So we went through various battles. And at one point, it looked as though there was an invitation to come up with some money that could help change the situation. It was in the sort of millions of dollars category, and I'm not really one for bribes anyway. We decided that the best thing to do temporarily actually was to go on a spousal permit, because I was pregnant at this point and worrying about what this was going to look like. I didn't want to live in a different continent to my husband and father of our child. But that meant you weren't allowed to work. And if you were found in a place of work, you could be told to leave the country. So it was untenable. So we now run Piccalilli remotely. We went back last year. The women are doing brilliantly. Thankfully, through WhatsApp and things, we can stay in touch. And as soon as we can get back there, we'll go back and do more training and spend some more time with women. But it's just incredible to see how they've totally embraced all of the challenges of running the workshop themselves. You know, they've recently signed themselves up for sort of Excel training and Word training. So the reports they send back to us aren't typed with manual calculations. They can do it automatically. And they're just really entrepreneurial. I love that. So it's working. It's definitely working. And I just love the fact that we have this constant connection to Africa now.
Give us an idea of the scale of Piccalilli at the moment. How many people are you, is it impacting?
Yeah, well, we have a staff of about 10. And every week, the women spend about half a day of their time training in schools around Wanza. So it's particularly around the passenger training. They've trained up thousands of kids. I mean, it's typically, we see evidence every week of them training absolutely ram-packed classrooms with hundreds of kids packed, sort of squashing 10 kids onto a bench probably designed for three. And these rooms are heaving, training them about road safety. Their parents are then now asking us, we've heard our kids telling us about this motorbike training, can you train us too? And the teachers love it. We've been awarded a grant as well to also run some motorbike rider specific training in the community and importing some safer quality helmets, doing all sorts of things. So the impact of their work is huge. And what can't ever be really measured, but certainly underestimated, is just the impact of them being seen locally, women riding around town on well-maintained motorcycles, staying safe, that whole thing of them being a role model and raising the standards. Actually in Wanza, where we're based, the local road traffic authority has kind of adopted Piccalilli almost as their own. And whenever they need to talk about road safety standards, they bring Piccalilli and the MJ Picky girls into the room. So even though they've actually had nothing to do with us, they're very happy to take the credit. Just actually, that's how it should be. It's a local product. That's great.
How can people kind of either help you, get in touch, support you?
They're always very welcome to emailing me, claire@piccalilli.com. That's P-I-K-I-L-I-L-Y. Or just find me on Facebook, Claire Elston, or Instagram or Twitter. But there's a few ways they can support if they want to. I mean, it's always great to just hear people's feedback and how excited they are about it or any thoughts they have about it. That's always great. I'll be honest, donations are always incredibly welcome. So I'll never turn those down, and they go a long way in Tanzania. But actually, there's a couple of projects that I have been sort of like rumbling away that should totally be figure outable and would make a massive impact to a lot of people that I just can't seem to get to the bottom of. So I'll give you one example, but there are more. Do you remember those roller skates that would grow with your feet so they could, you could make them bigger or smaller, the metal ones with a kind of nut, a couple of bolts underneath.
Yeah. Remember them well, yes.
So one of the big challenges we have is in many countries it's a legal requirement for a motorbike taxi driver to carry a spare helmet. So far so good. But what are you going to do? And this is something that several women in rural DRC raised, which I thought was an excellent question. But how big is that helmet going to be? Usually it's massive. It doesn't fit anybody. It's literally like the line of worst fit. It doesn't fit anybody. So people don't wear them. They discard them, whatever. But similarly for children, their heads are too small. Their helmet's just going to rattle around. It's going to do no good. So why is it not possible to design a helmet that can be adjusted to the size of the wearer? Because that should be in theory quite a simple thing to design, still lightweight, still breathable, but will actually be snugly fitting around the skull of the wearer so that people are more likely to wear it because it actually fits. Hopefully it's something that can easily be sanitized or cleaned between usages. Some people have mentioned to me about these like inflatable neck braces that I've seen, and that's fine as well. But it would be something that ideally could even be manufactured in Africa, keep it local. So if somebody could like answer that design challenge, whether it's like a university department or an engineer, I don't know.
It's a really good question.
That would save so many lives.
Claire, I've really, really enjoyed talking to you. I love your story. What are you doing now?
I've managed to turn my old trade for good purposes, which I'm delighted by. I'm now director of the capital markets team at CDP, which essentially works with big investors. So my old clients, essentially, big pension funds, investment funds, and they own shares in big companies who are high emitters. They create big climate impact. Basically, we work with those investors to ask those high emitting companies to report back through a sort of questionnaire process on what exactly their climate impact is and what they're doing about it. Those things can then be measured and managed, and it has been proven to work to encourage those companies to reduce their impact on the climate, which is a beautiful thing.
Claire, thank you so much for telling us the story. Best of luck with Piccalilli and best of luck with all the projects, and hopefully we'll check in with you again sometime soon. But thanks very much for talking to us on the Do Lectures podcast.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. I really appreciate it. the Do Lectures team really appreciate it. Please do leave us a review. Please do subscribe. And please do get in touch with me, gav@thedolectures.co.uk. This show was produced by George McDonough. The music's by James Morton. Please come back and listen in a couple of weeks for the next episode of Dot, Dot, Dot. In the meantime, stay safe, take care. Cheers, bye.